Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. We are speaking with Dr. Mimi Huang, PhD, a licensed clinical psychologist and noted activist for the bisexual community. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure, believe me.
I'm John.
I'm Lynette.
Hello.
So, Dr. Mimi, can you tell us about your work concerning mental health for the bisexual community?
Sure thing, Lynette. I mean, it really started off with my career in community organizing, first off, with my co-founding of the group called Fluid at UCLA, which was the first bisexual social support group there. Later on, I became a clinical psychologist, and I focused on multicultural issues, since to me that was such a big part of my own development, identity, and I felt that is a really important issue for a lot of folks who don't fit into the mainstream for whatever reason, whether it's ethnicity, sexual orientation, any other type of cultural identity. And my dissertation while I was in grad school was on bisexual identity, which I can talk more about later. Through my work, I've worked with a lot of different community mental health agencies as well as university counseling centers. And so I really kind of focused a lot on children, youth, teenagers, young adults, and so a lot of time of growing development and identity. And so I was able to really work with a lot of folks that were on the bisexual spectrum through that. And so through that, I got a lot of clinical experience, and now I'm doing a lot of clinical presentations and trainings for other therapists and mental health professionals. And along the way, I also co-founded two other bisexual groups. So that continued to inform a lot of the mental health work that I do. And also in line with the training that I do, a few years ago, I started my professor role at Antioch University, Los Angeles, and they have an LGBT specialization there for their master's in psychology program. And so I feel very blessed to work there and to teach the only bisexual affirmative therapy class. It's a one-day, eight-hour workshop for the master's in psychology students there. So it's a very, very unique opportunity and for me to train budding therapists. So that's also part of what I do. And my main job right now is working at Student Psychological Services at Loyola Marymount University.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
thank you. I will just say that we've done two interviews in the last few weeks, one with a therapist who works mainly with bi clients and one who works mainly with trans clients. And both of them said that they needed to do most of their training on the job. The bi therapist was in LGBT mental health in her school. And there was, a half day seminar on bisexuality for the whole coursework.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's really important that you're doing your work and helping therapists learn what we need.
Yes, absolutely.
Kind of goes in my first question. For a lot of us, last year's Celebrate Bisexuality Day White House event was really important. And I know that there was a lot about our health issues, especially our mental health issues. And since I've seen, since this happened, we've really done amazing work in even educating ourselves about our mental health issues. Could you talk a little bit about your work at the White House event and since?
Yeah, sure. It was definitely a really, really phenomenal time for the community. So it was a really amazing time. I felt so blessed to be one of the 33 bi leaders that was invited to this bisexual community roundtable at the White House. And, as you probably know, it was an off-the-record event, and so I can really only discuss what I did there. But my section of this three-hour meeting was to present on bisexual mental health. And so through that, I was actually tasked with, coming up with all of this data and research, which, a lot of this I had seen just through my community work and through, you know, the clients that I had worked with. But to see all of that, you know, all together with research backing it, it was just really, really impactful and also very startling because it just seemed that study after study that I was reading, it just kept showing that bisexual people were really doing the worst compared to heterosexual and even gay and lesbian people. You know, not only do we face minority stress, which I think in and of itself sometimes is kind of underestimated, that bisexual people are minorities, we are marginalized, we don't have that kind of privilege that a lot of people think we do. But not only that, we face a lot more adverse life events, which does affect our mental health. You know, that's a pretty intuitive thing. But now we have the data to back it up. And study after study, I mean, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, this goes for adults, this goes for college students, and it also goes for elders. So elders also faced poor mental health and higher risk of depression than gay and lesbian elders. And as you know, a lot of elders already are, you know, facing a lot of different lacks of resources and social isolation and things like that. So that's definitely a high risk group. With suicidality also, the stats were just really, really disturbing. You know, I think the common knowledge is that LGBT folks have, you know, face higher risk of suicidality and suicide risk and attempts than heterosexual people. But if you break it down between gay, bi, and lesbian, bisexual people face an even higher risk of lifetime suicidality, 6 times more than heterosexual people, whereas gay, lesbian is 4 times more risk. So that's just huge. And so to me, you know, all of this was like, now I know this information, I can't ignore it anymore. And now we're telling people about it. So, you know, people really can't ignore this anymore. Bisexual people are not doing well. And not only do we exist, but we really need support and we need help. The goal of this roundtable was really to present this information, to garner interest from White House officials, and to hopefully slowly get that dialogue going so that we can make some systemic change. So this, you know, on a personal level, it really galvanized my interest more in bisexual mental health specifically, not just, you know, general well-being, but mental health. And so I've, you know, tried to focus a lot more of my talks and presentations and community work on this issue. You know, myself and in my steering committee with the Los Angeles Bi Task Force, we talk more and more about each other's health, how we're doing these days. So it's just something that, you know, has really become on the forefront of my mind.
I think it's because of all of your good works at the White House. There was a lot of work that went on behind that, but I think that was a spark that ignited the community, because we are more aware of our issues now too, and we have voice for that, and that's very important.
Well, yes, the follow-up of the BRC and Bisexual Health Awareness Month, I think, really like put a lot of that together and put it out. And I will say, you know, it struck me when you were talking, because we have a bi mental health professional in my local bi group, and at one of our events, she said, you know, I know there's problems, but when I read these resources from the Bi Resource Center, it struck me how, you know, it shocked me. It even affects us who know by experience our issues.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, through all of my community work and the groups that I've run and the events that I've run, I mean, I've seen a lot of bisexual people not doing well. And even compared to, you know, gay groups, lesbian groups that are out there, you know, when I go to a bi event, I just see a lot of folks who don't seem to be doing well. And even our own LA community, within the past several years, there's been a few bi elders who died suddenly, you know, might have been suicide, you know, we aren't sure, but I mean, this affects us. You know, personally, it's not just numbers out there. So, but I think having the numbers just makes it in a way, it makes it not such an isolated incident. And
yes.
So now it's so there, it's in our face, and so it is very important to you know, do something about this. And our Los Angeles by Task Force, we actually, speaking of the health month, we published a bisexual health calendar back in March of this year, 31 Days of Bi Wellness. And so that was our, you know, attempt to really raise awareness and to educate people on resources that are out there to take care of their physical health, their physical, their emotional health, their, you know, their community health. So, you know, we're trying to take steps.
Yes, we utilized that calendar and shared it quite a bit. It was very helpful.
Great.
And I just want to say in my own life, because I often say I'm a walking bisexual statistic, really. It gave me a lot of retrospect on my own life, and that was good because, you know, you do feel quite alone, and then I see that, well, my story really wasn't that much different than a lot of other stories, and it was very helpful for me.
Yeah.
So you authored a couple books on bi women also. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, one of them was my dissertation, and the other one is a book chapter. But my dissertation, you know, I knew that I wanted to do something on bisexual identity, and my inspiration really came from reading a book called Tipping the Velvet. It was kind of a common book in the queer women's community. But I remember reading the story where the main character, she falls in love with a woman, and they have this relationship, but when other people discover their relationship, this girlfriend sort of kind of ran away and ended up with a guy. And to me, I got all these questions about, well, why did she do that? You know, was there something that she was ashamed of about their same-sex relationship? And this then led to this sort of affair or act of infidelity that you might call it. And I think at the time too, I was also experiencing, a lot of personal, experiences from lesbian women who, you know, were accusing bi women of being cheaters and, not being able to settle down. And so I came up with these sort of questions, research questions about, well, maybe infidelity that happens could be related to bi identity development. I mean, that could be, you know, something that causes this, and maybe some kind of internalized stigma. So something that could be external to the person and not just because, oh, they're bisexual, but they're facing this kind of prejudice. So I created this study to examine those three constructs. So bisexual identity, which I framed as bisexual identity congruent. So to me, the more congruent a person is with their attractions, their behaviors, their self-identification, to me that is sort of a symbol of more identity strength. And then I looked at internalized biphobia, and at the time there really wasn't any measure of that. There was no instrument or questionnaire for that, so I had to adapt that from the lesbian internalized homophobia scale. And then I created a measure for infidelity, and this is infidelity as measured in a monogamous, you know, an agreed upon exclusive relationship.
All right.
And so I, you know, distributed this study to women, and altogether I got about 87 women, and my results, I came up with some good results in terms of what I had thought. And so I found that the higher the bi-identity congruence in a person, the lower the internalized biphobia. So this definitely validated, you know, a suspicion that I had that, you know, the more congruent and kind of streamlined your identity, it, you know, there's some connection to having less of that, you know, internalized stereotypes and negativity. And I found that especially there were higher levels of pride and acceptance, you know, in women in my study who had more congruence. Also, when I looked at the participants who had cheated in their relationship versus those who had not cheated, those that had cheated had higher levels of internalized biphobia. So that also validate and confirm my suspicions that this kind of prejudice has something to do with their relationship behaviors, these, you know, unhealthy relationship behaviors.
Wow.
So it was very exciting to get this data, and not only, you know, that it kind of confirms my suspicions, but really this was the first time that identity congruence among bisexual people was looked at in a research study, and also, you know, internalized biphobia. I mean, that as a construct was never really studied empirically. So since my study, there have been a few other studies that have looked at internalized biphobia. So all of those findings were really, really great, and I was able to also adapt the Klein Sexual Orientation Grid in my study, the KSOG, which hopefully a lot of people are aware of. You know, Fritz Klein, when he originally created it, he actually didn't have a bisexual category. And so in my study, I adapted it. I put in some bisexual categories, and so now I have the KSOG adapted, which is also available on my website. And so, you know, that was also something that came out of the study.
Okay.
And so with my book chapter, you know, that came a little bit later, but I was asked to write a book chapter in the Essential Handbook of Women's Sexuality. This was by Dr. Donna Castaneda. And so my chapter was on bisexual women's sexuality. This is in volume 2. And so this, I really got a chance to talk a lot more, not only about my dissertation study, but really about bisexual women, just sexual identity and relationships in general. So I talk about sex and love with heterosexual men, sex and love with lesbian women, and sex and love with bisexual and transgender people, as well as culture and community. So I kind of cover a whole gamut there. And it's a book that's great, not just for therapists and counselors, educators, but really just community members, lay people. It's a very readable, book. And so I hope that, you know, a lot of people are able to, you know, read that and learn a little bit more about bisexual women's lives.
And you have that, link for that on your website, is that correct?
It is on my website, yes.
Okay, great. And for the study too.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, I was going to just follow up real quick on the congruence, because, you know, I had seen some of the other studies, and one of the stats that just screams out at me every time I see it is that the more, for women, the more openly bisexual they are, the less problems, especially health problems, they have. And so, it really, you kind of started that, like, idea that, you know, being out really, like, saves you.
Yeah, you know, it does. And it's been pretty a common and, I think, intuitive thing that we understand about gay and lesbian people. But for some reason, it hasn't really trickled to the bisexual community. You know, I think a lot of bisexual people still are in hiding. They're still trying to live quietly, they may be trying to pass, and even if they go to see a therapist, that therapist might not necessarily encourage them to come out. But it, you know, why wouldn't it be the same for bisexual people, or any other cultural minority? You know, when you hide something about who you are, that means that there's a sense of shame and pain about it. And so the more you can just say, this is who I am, and it's okay, and I'm proud of it, it's normal, it's natural, it's real, you know, the less of that burden it is, and the better your mental health. So, and, you know, also there have been studies with men as well that have shown that the more concealment that bi men have regarding their identity, the poorer their mental health. So it's the same for bi men as well.
Yeah, I can say from personal experience, that's true. Living a lie or leading a double life is not a healthy way to live.
Well, you just feel wrong about yourself. And even if you, you know, in your mind know that possibly you're not, you still do psychologically because you're hiding. I mean, and when that, you know, the two things go together and the mind and body go together. So the physical The physical problems do not surprise me at all. So let's get going.
Okay.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about the calendar, but what else does the LA Bi Task Force do in the bisexual community, and what is its program?
So the Los Angeles Bi Task Force was started in 2008, and it was upon the urging of Jerry Massari, who's a longtime bisexual activist here in Los Angeles. He really felt that we needed to create some kind of a center for bisexual people. And so at first we were called the LA Bi Center Planning Committee, and we had a loose steering committee of different folks, and we even got some help from Faith Cheltenham and Kyle Schickner and Mike Szymanski and some of the bi bigwigs in our community. We had some difficulty getting sponsorship for an actual center or facility, so we started to focus on programs, which we've been doing. And so our goals now really are kind of three-pronged. We do education, we do cultural enrichment, and we do advocacy. And so our signature programs are Visibility at LA Pride, our annual Bi Arts Fest, which commemorates Celebrate Bisexuality Day on September 23rd, which we do have a very big and special event coming up this September 23rd. And we're going to be featuring the new Spectrum Artist Collective, which is a new gathering in Los Angeles. But so we've done the Bi Health Month calendar. We've invited Dr. Lisa Diamond to talk. And so we're still growing. We became a registered nonprofit in 2010, and we're now currently trying to work on our 501c3 status. This year, we also launched our needs assessment, which is the first bisexual, pansexual, and fluid community needs assessment in the greater LA area. So we're really trying to collect data. Again, I think, data collection can be very, very useful for these kinds of things. And so we're trying to, hear directly from the people, and hopefully we'll be able to write a report, publish it, and give it out to different agencies so that they can start trying to integrate bisexual needs into their programs.
We are big fans of data around here, and we're glad you're doing that, the resources to reach out to the other communities, because we really need that, too. Involved with the other group there, MBI. Where's it been, and where is it headed?
Well, so MBI, I originally started in 2006, and it started off as this kind of a small monthly coffee meeting, and at the time it was pronounced AMBI, which stood for a meeting of bi individuals. It really grew out because there wasn't a bi group at the time. We had BiNet LA, which had, been around LA for some long number of years, but that had fell inactive. And so after I finished my dissertation, I was really just, excited to get, my study and my information out there. And so we started meeting, and I also wanted it to be something that was beyond just a sit in a circle type group, which, there was already at the time with our local LGBT center. I felt like for people that maybe had already figured out that they were bi, they needed something a little bit more active, something that was out and about. And so that was really kind of the tone that I set for AMBI at the time. All of our events were out in public venues, like at restaurants, go bowling, watch movies. To me, it just was, we're normal people, and we do normal fun things together. And so it continued to grow, and now it's on meetup.com, led now by Ian Lawrence, and we've grown so big. We have, I think, close to 1,000 members at this point, with events pretty much, all throughout the month. Which is really exciting, especially for such a large metropolitan area like Los Angeles. You really want to try to tap into people in different areas geographically. So there's assistant organizers now who run events, and I'm more of a background role at this point since I've been busy with the clinical and LA Bi Task Force. But it still is really a great tool for community building, for people just to meet other bisexual people, and to have a good time. And I think we're kind of moving towards expanding even outside of LA, to different counties and cities. And so, You know, I think it's a really good model for bi groups in general. Mm-hmm. And so I really hope that it can serve as kind of a template for bi groups in other cities. Because sometimes when you run a bi group, it kind of becomes like the thing that is for everyone. And for whatever reason, you know, if a bisexual person comes to one event, they may not, you know, like that event, or it's too far from them or something like that. So the way that AmBi works now, there's just multiple events to choose from. There's different people organizing each event, and so it just creates sort of a greater likelihood that someone will enjoy themselves and return. Mm-hmm. That's really been important in just retaining membership, since that's oftentimes a struggle, is maintaining people in the bi community. So I think that's really worked out.
Fantastic. And we have that's great. We applaud you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, keep it up.
It sounds almost like the stuff we're trying to do over here in Washington with Center Bi. And if there's resources to share of, like, how-tos, that would be helpful so that I can train my organizers. But we need to really move and deal with the real tofu that at the end.
We have several questions concerning the overall state of mental health and the mental health profession. What do you find is our biggest concern right now?
You know, that's a tough question, because I think there are a lot of big concerns. As you know, you heard me talk about earlier, there's just so many staggering statistics, and it's like, how, you know, which one do you work on first? But for me, you know, I think it really starts with identity development. That's the first thing. You know, you can't go out there and start groups and change the world unless you yourself feel okay about who you are. And I think so much of bi identity development is impacted by internalized biphobia.
Yes.
I mean, it's really not something that we talk about often, but I think it affects all of us, because it's around all of us, everywhere, every day, on TV, in movies, you know, in high schools and your workplace. And you can't help but absorb this kind of negativity or invisibility. And so I think bisexual people really absorb this, knowingly or unknowingly.
Mm-hmm.
And this affects what we think about ourselves. It affects how we carry ourselves, whether or not we may mention something about our bisexual identity or lives in some kind of social setting. And so, you know, this is really kind of, I think, the heart of what affects bisexual people's mental health. And then in turn, that affects our relationships, you know, our dating relationships, marriages if we're married. You know, people may be very afraid to come out to their partners. They might not come out until the relationship has, you know, really evolved, and there might be marriage and kids, which can then be a very, very risky time to come out. And, or the person may not, you know, develop a sustained relationship,
mm-hmm.
because they, you know, are sometimes kind of internalize a lot of stereotypes themselves.
Yes.
That, you know, maybe we can't find love, which is absolutely not true at all. So, you know, I think that this affects us in a very deep level. And then along with relationships, of course, comes sexual health. And so if a person is really not feeling okay about who they are and they feel really ashamed, they may not conduct themselves with the most responsibility or care when it comes to sexual intimacy. So, you know, they may not protect themselves, they may not know how to, or have a partner that may be pressuring them, and maybe utilizing bisexual stereotypes against them. You know, there's also data out there about interpersonal, intimate partner violence, and I think that a lot of bisexual women especially may be hearing a lot of negative, bi messages from their own partners, especially their monosexual partners, gay and gay and straight. And so this can then, of course, lead to health problems and all sorts of other issues. And then I think lastly is finding community.
Mm-hmm.
And this is so important. I think that, you know, in terms of just needs of a human being, you know, on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, finding a community is the second most important thing next to food and shelter. And so if you don't have a place where you can feel at home, where you feel accepted and nurtured just for who you are, then, you know, everything else is shaky. And so bisexual folks, you know, depending on where they live, they may or may not have community. You know, luckily, you know, there are multiple bi groups here in Los Angeles. But if someone is out in a more rural part of the country, or it's just really far, they don't have transportation, it can be really, really tough to find, you know, other people like them. So, you know, they may have to resort to online communities, or they may just have to start one, you know. But I think that it's so important to find people where you really don't have to explain yourself. And so these are, I think, some of the foundations in terms of mental health that bisexual people are needing to address.
Thank you.
Yeah, this leads into my question, which is the boilerplate question we always ask bisexual therapists. How do we find bi-friendly and bi-positive therapy when we're looking for mental health resources? And, you know, I was burned when I was very young by what I thought was an LGBT friendly counselor who was really just a gay friendly counselor. and so many of us have been. And, so how do we go and find someone when we need therapy that is going to respect us as bisexuals and not try to say you have to choose or it's a problem?
Yeah, it is not an easy quest. You know, I think that this is definitely a continuing issue. You know, there are some resources that are out there online. BiZone created a bisexuality aware professionals directory. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's on the Bisexual Resource Center website, but I don't know
It's a little dated.
Yeah. But that's really the only national directory that I've seen. You know, for us here in LA, I started to create a referral list of therapists around this area. And so through the people that I've trained or through friends or colleagues that I have, I've created this little list. So, you know, it really, I think, boils down to the bisexual leaders within each area to try to come up with something, because otherwise it really is hit or miss. You know, you can look on Psychology Today, you can look on LAGPA, which is the Lesbian Gay Psychotherapy Association, and maybe you can type in the keyword bisexual, but it can be, again, you know, not really a sure thing, because it could be someone who says that they're bisexual friendly, but maybe may not be bisexually aware. I mean, sure, they might be accepting, but they may not really know a lot of the ins and outs. And so it really is tough. So, you know, I think that just sort of something to cope with all this is for, you know, bisexual individuals, if you're looking for a therapist, I say screen them. You know, screen them from the get-go. You know, even on the phone call or your first session with them, ask them if they have worked with bisexual clients or they have any competence around this issue. See if they say yes or no. Even if they say no, maybe see if they're willing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least that could be something that could still be important. You know, there are plenty of straight and gay therapists that are very well-meaning and who would be open to learning. So, you know, have that be a follow-up question. And then if your therapist does express some inaccurate stereotypes, I would say, you know, try to correct them, you know, if you feel up to it, because, you know, you have a right to not have a therapist who gives you inaccurate information. And if you do end up working with someone who's really great, I say, you know, spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell your local bi group about it or your local LGBT center and let them know that this is a, you know, a vetted, you know, person, And so then that way other people will find out about them. So therapist shop, you know, really be selective because it is such an important relationship and you don't want someone who is actually going to do you more harm than good.
Dara Hoffman Fox in Colorado started a group or program that she borrowed from someone else and uses the model where it is trans-friendly to trans-aware group of psychologists and counselors who meet every month and share information, and also they also refer around to each other, and so that I thought that was a really good idea, and it seems to be working.
Yeah, and I'm currently organizing my my mental health professionals to create a referral list and to try to work together a little bit to, you know, to provide those resources for us here. So that when I go to a meetup event and someone asks, where do I find a counselor? I can say, here's a sheet.
Yes. I mean, that's where it all starts. It all starts with the individual, you know, with an idea, right? And then that starts to create, you know, resources and community.
So we talked about what, you know, on a community level, what the mental health field should be accomplishing in the future. What about for, as in training on, like a standardization of training, there is LGBT training. I'm assuming I have never been, you know, but I've heard that, you know, psychologists are trained in, you know, in some gender studies. Would you like to see that be a little more specific and be like standardized for all when you're in school?
You know, that would be wonderful. As a psychologist, I mean, there's different standards for marriage and family therapists as well as licensed clinical sex workers. But for psychologists, we do have to get a human sexuality course to be licensed. And so it touches on LGBT. Now, you know, it all depends on who the person training and how much time they spend on the B. But I would love for that class to really partition out LGBT, so that the B doesn't just get a little bit of lip service. I also just think, you know, therapists should just get trained. I mean, you know, we do all need to get continuing education, to keep up our license. And so I think continual education classes, supervision, consultation, these are all things that we need to be doing to keep up with our work. And so, you know, of course, there also needs to be trainers. And so if there's, you know, a community leader, you know, in that area who's willing to step up and say, you know, I can be a trainer, I can come and do this talk, that also provides a resource. So, you know, I do what I can here in LA, and I've done a training for Trevor Project, as well as different universities and mental health clinics. But I'm just one person, you know, and so I hope that we can, as a community, also develop this kind of competence so that we can go out there and help the mental health profession.
Well, we do too. And we're hopeful. We're very optimistic about all of this. One more question. The issue of obtaining proper bisexual specifics, statistics and funding is a real problem. We do not see many studies available at the moment. It does seem to be increasing, though. Do you see an increase in studies for us?
I think currently it seems like there are more studies on bisexual issues just singularly. And then I'm also starting to see more studies that are partitioning the L, G, and B and T, you know, at times. So that's very important, because I think when you lump us all together, it seems like we all have the same needs, but when you actually, you know, create different groups, you see the numbers come out differently. So I think that, this is great because in the world of grants and scholarships, you know, people need to see numbers. They need to see how many people are there in this group. And what are their issues that you're dealing with? And why should this money be granted to this program? Also in issues of medicine and health, you know, research, you know, really means a lot. We live in a very kind of science-oriented, you know, culture. So in some ways, you know, we need to kind of structureize and operationalize what bisexual means in this kind of, you know, studies. You know, are we just talking about self-identification? Are we talking about behavior? Or are we talking about attraction? You know, because really, all of those different constructs, you can come up with different numbers. And so if at least these studies can start using the same language, we can then compare them side by side. And I think also what's important for researchers to know is that bisexual people use many different labels. So, you know, we've been using the term bisexual in this interview, but there are a lot of other labels out there, pansexual,
yes,
fluid, monosexual, you know, anthrosexual. I mean, the list goes on. And mm-hmm. So researchers hopefully will be aware that in order to capture this community that's, you know, that doesn't fall into the gay only or straight only, you actually need to be aware that there's different self-identifications. And hopefully, you know, more bisexual people will come out and participate in these studies, you know, because that's really the only way that we can get good data, is if the community, you know, really speaks up. And
mm-hmm. Yes.
And that way there's good data, trusted data. So, you know, hopefully with more studies, we can really understand a lot more and start to get better programs.
Yes, thank you for saving my question. I worded that all wrong, and I apologize. But yes, you said what I wanted you to say.
Great. Yeah.
You got the point.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I think the date of the blow-up was, remember, like, I think it was late 2007 or early 2008 when the HRC did an internet survey of LGBT people and whether they liked Hillary or Barack. And not only did the majority support Obama, but the majority was bisexual. And it was one of those things that was a teachable moment, I think, for a lot of people. And I actually think it was a teachable moment for the Williams Institute, because they are one of the organizations that does a lot now to break us out in studies. So we want to stress the importance of community building to promote self-value and peer support. We want to thank you for joining us today and taking more time than you budgeted. And also thanks for all your hard work and all you've done for us. I see the stuff that you do on the internet and through reading and such, and I know that you're a really valuable resource for us. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
We appreciate you very much. So is there anything else you'd like to ask right now?
I think that covers it. You know, I think in general, we just need to treat ourselves better. You know, hopefully gays and straights can also learn to treat us better. But we, you know, it really starts with us taking care of ourselves and practicing self-care and, you know, sleeping and eating well and making friendships and taking care of ourselves. And so I just hope that, you know, conversations like this will get that started.
We do too. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All the links will be provided on the website. I just want to remind everybody, you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Yes, thank you. Bye.
It was great.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun. I kind of stumbled around that one question, but yeah.
Well,
how
I had
that
notes in front of me.
Good.
That kind of helped me, and I'd already kind of prepped some talking points for myself. Yeah.
I should have just backed up and started over, but it was like, okay, I'm already here.
Yeah.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.
I would love to get the grant money to pay you to come out to D.C. and talk to the mental health professionals in my own Center by group to get that all started, to train the trainers.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to.
You know, and it's funny because I was at a, you know, I was at a party in the neighborhood like, a few months back. And, you know, I got into this conversation over drinks with a therapist who works with AIDS patients in DC. And, you know, just talking to her about, you know, by issues, she's, you know, she's gay friendly. And, you know, she's like, you know, a lot of times when I have bi clients, I don't know what to do and what to say. And yeah. If I were trained, I would feel better at doing my job.
Exactly.
It's not like people don't care. It's that they just haven't had the training, and they haven't got the skills.
I mean, even bisexual therapists, you know, I mean, it's not just because you're bisexual, it makes you an awesome bisexual therapist, but, you know, even some bisexual people who maybe just haven't done a lot of reading on issues or worked in the community, you know, they themselves might still be working out their own stuff. So, yes. You know, I think we just need education.
Absolutely. I take my life, because this whole podcast has been a learning process and a growing process for me, because this month is actually my first year anniversary coming out. So yes, this is all very...
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wow,
thank you so
you've
much.
Done such great work for your first year.
Oh, well, I'm old. I know how to learn.
I got her back.
Yeah, he does.
Good.
He
I've been out
sure
for a long time.
Yeah. He covers it for me. Makes me understand.
Good.
I can see that, you know, when I first came out, I didn't have any idea what, you know, and I did feel alone and without community, and I had no idea what I was even being stigmatized, you know, because it's so insidious. And so, yeah, I can really see how that, you know, getting together and being in a community and self-love is so important. Yeah.
This is Saint Zero from The Headphone Bleed, and you're listening to The Bicast. Symptoms may include an open mind, sense of community, shinier hair, and whiter teeth.
Results may vary.
You can catch me every Saturday night at www.live365.com/stations/Saint Zero.
Nip it back.